are you?
John, hi, how are you?
Pretty good.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah, Merry Christmas. I've got a... I put a mistletoe behind me and wrapped some Christmas lights around it. People probably just see this kind of red glowing blob. But I want them to know that it's a Christmas plant. Poinsettia.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Poinsettia. I should have arranged my Christmas lights so that they were visible in the camera. I just put a string out on this this portal outside my office.
Uh-huh. Are you guys, is it snowed there yet?
Yeah. We got, it's been more than a week. And let's see, about 10 days ago we got five or six inches. And then a little more after that, just in flurries. And now it's all just kind of melting and icy. But there's a lot of snow up in the mountains, so the skiers are happy.
Well, listen, first hockey game of the year yesterday. It was the Thursday afternoon club. We played on a little pond called Lake Alice, where we always play all the year. And beautiful game, 4-on-4. The ice was like polished marbles, just amazing. It was almost the problem with playing when the ice is that hard and slick is that if somebody misses the pass, the puck takes off across the a pond. It takes quite a while to retrieve it, and there is still a little bit of open water around the edges in some parts of the pond, and the puck goes plopping into the water. But we have plenty of spare pucks.
Force equals mass times acceleration.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you could do. Yeah, it could be like those old physics lab frictionless tracks, and you could do experiments.
It is. It's what's
on acceleration, what's, time squared, and all that stuff.
What's fun sometimes is watching. You know, the puck is headed toward the edge of the ice, and you've got a hockey player in full pursuit trying to catch it before it gets to the edge, and of course he's got to make a calculation as he's getting closer to the edge himself as to whether he keeps going and even accelerates to try to cut the puck off at the risk of crashing into the water himself.
Yeah, that's such an interesting thing, this internal physics we have.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you quizzed someone, you know, they would probably, you know, what they would tell you, you know, if someone had never taken a physics class or it had been a long time, and they would just probably assume all of the old Aristotelian physics, you know, that something can only be in motion if there's a force constantly applied to it, instead of the Newtonian idea that, you know, that's actually, you know, once you impart the force, it'll keep going until a counterforce stops it. But of course, the counterforce is often friction acting gradually, so it appears that you need a force to keep it going. And yet, you know, we can, you know, hit baseballs and things like that. So our brains are obviously calculating these trajectories, and then science describes these trajectories using calculus. And yet, our brains are, you know, clearly not doing calculus. It's all very interesting.
You know, I do. When you were talking, it reminded me of this piece I clipped from Nature. Jesus, it's 4 years old now, more than 4 years old, that I just put in a file of interesting stuff that might be worth talking about or writing about at some point. It's it's a little essay from Nature called Outsmarted by Ants, and it's about how ants have these apparently really clever, sophisticated strategies for getting back to a nest after they go out foraging for food. And it says in here that, the lead, Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, died in 1988, was smart. Omni magazine once declared him the smartest man in the world. But clever as he was, Feynman was outwitted by an ant, or rather by a colony of ants. So the idea is that, you know, it's kind of a groupthink that is manifested by some of these social instincts, and they are insects, and they solve really complicated algorithms that would be very difficult for a team of artificial intelligence engineers to solve. So
And yet they're probably, I don't know, that's the interesting question. Are they really solving algorithms, or is that just, you know, the way in our blinded manner that we think about it and explain it.
Well, somehow the algorithms are instantiated in their neural circuitry.
Probably, but I don't know. It's it gets philosophically difficult. I mean, it's like the protein folding problem.
Yeah.
You know, where proteins, the amino acids are strung together, and then they spontaneously fold up into this complex shape that defines their particular function, like as an enzyme in a biological reaction. And then the protein folding problem is considered NP complete, meaning that it's exponentially difficult. Like the more amino acids there are, it gets exponentially more difficult to solve the problem. And it's this big, huge thing where you can use the world's biggest supercomputers and they can only approximate how a protein will fold, and yet the protein knows how to do it.
Yeah. I sometimes...
And yet, that's not quite the way to think about it, because, I mean, the protein, I mean, is it really processing information?
Yeah.
I mean, it just does it.
Right.
And then we have to figure out some algorithmic way to explain it to ourselves, and it becomes far more complex than whatever just doing it means.
Yeah, I sometimes think about that applied to nature as a whole. How does nature know how to keep doing its thing year after year and eon after eon down to the tiniest detail? It just seems like it should all come crashing to a halt at some point. And who knows, maybe it will because of humans fucking everything up so much.
It's the old, there's someone who said or asked, are the planets solving differential equations as they orbit elliptically around the sun? Or maybe they said that they're, you know, the planets are obviously not doing this, and yet if we can describe them that way to any desired degree of precision. So
yeah, well, there is this idea going back to, well, I know that Ed Fredkin was one of the first to start talking about it, I think in the 1960s, an artificial intelligence engineer at MIT, and then Steve Wolfram has talked about it more recently, that the whole universe is in some sense a computer carrying out these complicated computations. But really, that metaphor doesn't do justice, doesn't even come close to doing justice to what nature pulls off routinely.
Well, you could have your algorithms embedded in algorithms and make it as complex as you like.
Yeah.
But kind of the interesting overall idea, I think, is, you know, if you have any kind of computation or any kind of string of information, like a computer program, which is just a big string of ones and zeros, and you can figure out another program to compress it, you know, like to make it smaller and fit into a smaller storage space. But at some point, you'll get to where the string of digits, the ones and zeros, is incompressible and it can't be further squeezed down, and then it's indistinguishable from a random string of information. There's no real pattern in it that you can exploit to make it smaller. And in a way, you know, the universe is like this algorithm, and the only way you can really know what it's doing is, in other words, you can't take this very complex program beyond a certain point and examine it and tell you what it's going to do, or how long it's going to take to do it. You just have to run it. And maybe 5 seconds later or 5 millennia later, it'll finish cranking through all these steps and come out with the outcome. And there's no way to compress this.
And
so
by that time,
the universe
is
incompressible.
You might as well just watch what nature does anyway instead of running the...
Yeah, just let it unfold. And yet, somehow we're able to come up with these laws that capture a huge amount of it.
And that help put humans on the moon. Well, what does that say about... How does that apply to the search for a unified theory of physics?
Did you see yesterday that the scientists, you know, the Sudan mine experiment up in the Iron Range in Minnesota, where they have these detectors down in the bottom of an iron mine to protect them from cosmic ray interference, and they're claiming that they may have detected over the course of 2 years a grand total of 2 particles of dark matter.
is that news or?
I mean, it was like really it was ricocheting all over the internet yesterday because there was this there were 2 conferences, one in California and one in I think Illinois at Fermilab maybe, but There's a really good piece about this in Science News. This guy was right on the story. But basically, these are these things called WIMPs, these particles.
Oh, yeah.
Weakly interacting massive particles. Yeah, remember those?
I didn't even know that those were still viable. I thought those were one of the many hypothetical particles that just come and go without ever becoming real, becoming observed.
Blast from the past.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, the thing about dark matter is it only interacts gravitationally. It doesn't put out any electromagnetism or any light. So it's really obviously hard to detect. But apparently these WIMPs, they're called weakly interacting because they do feel the weak nuclear force, mm-hmm. just slightly. So they have these detectors, and if there is a WIMP, you know, a wind of WIMPs that the Earth is riding through, you know, this dark matter that, you know, makes up 80% of the universe, supposedly. So if a WIMP goes through this detector, there's a tiny little chance that it'll interact through the weak nuclear reaction with one of these atoms in the detector, silicon or germanium, it's a semiconductor. And when it does this, it'll make a little vibration and emit, you know, they call them phonons, but basically it's a vibration or a little heat wave. And they'll detect this heat wave, and then they'll say, aha, you know, that was a WIMP. Or actually, I think there's a certain chance that's a WIMP. And after doing this for over years, they got two of these events.
I guess that's exciting. So WIMPs are, the M in WIMP is for massive particle, to distinguish them from super light or massless particles like neutrinos, right?
Yeah, and some people think WIMPs are the supersymmetric partner of neutrinos, so that they're neutralinos.
Uh-huh.
So you know, that's what interests me, that, you know, in the modern days of particle physics, what counts as a detection, and, you know, it's not a discovery yet, but a possible discovery, is getting these events that are so rare that you capture two of them over the course of years after all this effort, and then there's a, what is it, 23% chance that they're false alarms, that the same signature was reproduced by, like, decaying radioactive particles down in the mine. I mean, they try to protect against that. So they have to do all these tests to rule out that as best as they can. You know, then now they're saying that, you know, for this to really be a discovery, like, if over the next few years they find four more, you know, then it's like, slam dunk.
Well, what does this mean? What are the implications for the standard model? I mean, does this favor any kind of serious revision of the standard model, or is it something that
it, to the limited extent that I understand it, if these things, if you can make the strong case that these are supersymmetric partners of neutrinos, it would be a feather in the cap of this idea of supersymmetry, that every particle has this little mirror particle, and a lot of the theories of everything depend on supersymmetry as being true in order to, you know, put together a grand theory.
Right.
So that would be a big thing.
And supersymmetry, I guess, is a necessary, although not sufficient, property for confirming the possibility of string theory.
It's a piece of it, or at least a piece of some string theories, and you know, there's some people who are really more interested in, like, the idea of supersymmetry by itself, and
Jesus,
you know, that's where they came up with all these great names, you know, like the like gluons, you know, the particles that cause the nucleus, the quarks, to stick together to make the nucleons, so there would the gluons would have these shadow particles called gluinos. Mm-hmm.
Take me back. It's just like from the early mid 90s when particle physics was still generating a lot of news. I'll be honest, George. I'm so cynical now that I wonder if the scientists are releasing this now, just because particle physics is in such horrible shape, and they desperately need news.
This is really, you know, this is very exciting stuff.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they've been working on this for a long time, and they're apparently flabbergasted to get these two events after all these years. But
That would be exciting. Again, Jesus, supersymmetry would be. I mean, that would be a big event in particle physics. I don't know if it would be enough to really salvage the field anymore. I mean, the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, has got to start producing some interesting results. You probably saw the piece by Dennis Overby in the Times. Once again, they're not drinking champagne, but they're because.
Oh yeah, they ramped it up to not near the top energy that they planned to bring it to by now or long before now, but they're inching up on it.
Yeah,
and they surpassed the Fermi lab accelerator.
They did. Okay, but so they're still
in power. So that's a big step. But yeah, it's really discouraging. I mean, they wanted to be much further by now, but it's interesting too. These like the Sudan mine experiment. This is just like so much more. I won't say low tech, but. Certainly much less expensive.
Well, I know they used to have
much, much smaller little, like almost not quite a tabletop experiment, but because you have to use like cryogenics to cool down these detectors to near absolute zero and things like this.
Well, they used to have one of those mine experiments. I assume it's still operating. One of the ones that was used to detect neutrinos from the supernova in, I don't know what it was, 88, 89,
yeah.
Remember that big supernova? And as I recall, it's basically a giant vat, like a huge aquarium filled with
dry cleaning fluid.
Dry cleaning fluid, right.
Perchloride or something, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went to the one once, there's one in the bottom of a nickel mine in southern Ontario.
Uh-huh.
And it was really cool. I went there, and then you meet the scientists, and they have a trailer, and then you get together all the physicists, and then you put on your hard hats, and they pick up their lunch boxes, and they get on the mining elevator along with all the nickel miners.
Right.
Like these grisly rough and tumble nickel miners, and then there's these physicists who you actually don't seem much different from the miners, because these are experimental physicists.
Right.
These aren't these
tough guys
theorists. And then we go down in this clattering mining elevator, and the mining elevator stops at one tunnel, and the miners get off, and it stops at another tunnel, and the physicists get off, and then we go down this long track with like a train car track for mining ore. And just this dark, dingy place with the little lights on our helmets shining out. And then get to this door and go inside, and it's just like suddenly like the Andromeda Strain.
Uh-huh.
This like super high-tech laboratory underneath the Earth, and you have to go through this cleaning thing where you change your, you take your clothes off and put on these clean lab suits and go through an airlock and all this stuff.
Wow.
And then just all this amazing high-tech equipment.
Uh-huh. That reminds me of
this huge vat. Yeah. This wasn't dry cleaning fluid. It was something else, because this was an experiment where they're trying to show the three different types of neutrinos existed.
Yeah, which they finally did.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Is now...
Anyway, I think this stuff's kind of cool, but at the same time, it just really... You're kind of taken aback when you think, what counts now... So if they find four more of these over the next few years, that'll be a total of six events, and then they will say, it can be said to have discovered the WIMP.
Right.
And you contrast that to, like, the discovery of the electron.
Yeah.
Where you could just do consistently, like even a high school physics class can replicate the experiment with a fairly minimum amount of equipment, and you're talking about events that happen so commonly that they're, very much affect all the things around us in a way that we can measure. And then you get it's almost like physics has been so successful that it's just pushed out to this edge where all that's left are these incredibly, extremely rare events like detecting a dark matter particle that'll just, I don't know, it's just confusing.
It's funny.
Perplexing or something.
It's funny you bring up particle physics, because I was thinking that... We would have to do all this heavy lifting today and talk about climate change and what's going on in Copenhagen and the climate gate stolen emails and all that bullshit, and then and then of course there's the debate over healthcare and all these incredibly complex sort of science, social, political problems that just have they're just so multidimensional and so politicized. And I was thinking how great it would be if we could just talk about something really simple like particle physics.
Something simple like particle physics.
I mean, really, you know?
Well, yeah, simple. And I think I see what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, it seems simple to me. I wasn't necessarily trying to have a segue there. I'm actually.
No, it sounds like a good one. Well, yeah.
Because I've been trying to figure out where I stand on the climate gate issue. I know it's already been talked about a lot on Blogging Heads. Just a couple of things. Mm-hmm. One is that Andy Revkin, who he's a neighbor of mine. I live in Cold Spring. Right. He lives right next door in Garrison. And his name came up in the whole discussion of climate gate. I guess he had some emails to both the people in East Anglia, the Climate Research Unit, and to this guy, Michael Mann, who I guess is at the University of Pennsylvania, who was the person mainly responsible for the hockey stick graph showing the sharp spike in global temperatures recently.
Right.
And I think one of the most distressing things that I noticed in the whole affair was that Michael Mann, really respected, very good climatologist, he was complaining to, I think it was Phil Jones, one of the guys at East Anglia, who is, right at the center of creating these charts of a rise in temperature recently and over the last few centuries. Mann complained to Jones that Andy Revkin is, quote, not as predictable as we'd like. So, a lot of these people are talking about how to spin things. I also thought of Chris Mooney, who's also been on Blogging Heads. And, I had to conclude that I think these people could be seen as taking seriously Chris Mooney's call for more sophisticated framing on the part of the global warming researchers to try to sway public opinion. Here these people are doing it. They're trying to orchestrate a public relations campaign, and you're seeing kind of some of the seamy side of that going on behind closed doors, and it doesn't look good, I must say.
On the other hand, if you take anybody's private email like that, hack into their computer. I mean, so much of that has been just completely misinterpreted. Like the way a scientist or a mathematician will talk about coming up with a neat trick for, massaging some very complex, muddy data to try to get some kind of meaningful signal out of it. And then this was taken by all the global warming skeptics as meaning, oh, yeah, we're going to trick those people into thinking the numbers say something different from what they do, which couldn't be further from the truth.
Well, right. I realize I certainly don't think this in any way validates the claims of people like Inhofe or whatever the hell his name is, who say that global warming is a big hoax perpetrated by God knows what, some kind of communist Luddite conspiracy.
Yeah. Well, a lot of this I think we can blame the late, great Michael Crichton for, that novel that he wrote where it actually depicts it as a big conspiracy and the scientists are conspiring with the environmentalists.
But I think...
people love that stuff, and that's how most people think the world works.
But I think the scientists... what has bothered me about the kind of... The hardcore, it's not even a good term, but there's some people who are associated with a kind of dogmatic position on global warming and what should be done about it. And I'd say Michael Mann is one. And the idea that they would, Andy Revkin is as much as an environment, he's as green as anybody I know. And the idea that they would even see somebody like Andy, who I think has been extraordinarily good at reporting on climate change, accurate, covering all sides of the issue, being as unbiased as possible, and also constantly making the story fresh. The idea that they would say something like this about Andy not being predictable because he's diverging from this hardcore party line is very distressing to me. And it actually reminds.
I just don't know how much I'd want to put into like one offhand comment that was never, you know, meant for.
Well, here, let me offer a couple examples. When Jørn Lomborg, this Danish, I think he's an economist originally, published The Skeptical Environmentalist in 2001, I think it was, Scientific American devoted a big chunk of a whole issue to denouncing him. It was almost like he was being excommunicated. He was treated with such contempt. And I remember thinking it was overkill, and I didn't like the sense of there being such a dogmatic position that any divergence from that, any questioning of it was had to be stamped out. And that's really, it's bothered me more and more over time. I've seen some of this and the reaction to some of the stories that Andy Revkin has written. He's written some pieces, for example, about some possible positive consequences of global warming. For example, a boom in tourism around the Hudson Bay. And, you know, some of this is kind of jokey, but the reaction that he gets is like so outraged that I think it shows that... The solution to this, I think, and this has been proposed, there was an article in the Times about it, is that I do think there should be, an issue like that's so important as this, that there should be complete transparency.
Oh, well, sure.
But,
yeah.
I mean, there isn't now.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
And some of these, and, you know, these guys, the Anglia people, were talking about how they were trying to delete emails, and, you know, maybe I'm overreacting now, too, but it's, you know, I think science at its best, this is the problem that I had with Mooney and the whole framing of science issue. I think good science, maybe this is naive, but I think good science will prevail on its own.
It shouldn't need a frame.
Yeah, it will prevail on its own merits.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, in that light, there's a really, you know, I was just reading, you know, yesterday there was that big... what was it called? What did David
Kerfuffle?
Kaloran call it, our producer.
Kerfuffle. Kerfuffle.
I was thinking, was it a brouhaha or a kerfuffle between James Randi, the great skeptic magician who wrote something, you know, mildly skeptical of global warming, and then P.Z. Myers jumped on him, and Sean Carroll got into the, you know, jumped in with a, you know, more reasoned approach as he tends to do. But in, you know, just reading through all that, you know, same old kind of stuff, Sean linked to this really, really great graphic. It's called Information is Beautiful, is the name of the website.
Uh-huh.
And they have all these different visualizations, and there's one called Climate Change Deniers versus the Consensus.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just the best thing I've seen, just going down point by point, and first giving the, you know, the climate change doubters kind of... you know, if anything, the upper hand by giving them the left-hand column and then just very clearly stating, you know, without parody or mockery what their position is,
mm-hmm.
and then versus the scientific consensus, and then just very clearly conceptualizing that, and there's some nice little graphs and things. And then you get to the bottom, and you really can see why people, you know, disagree over this stuff and how difficult it is in the science that's dealing with all this incredibly messy, conflicting, incomplete data, and how you're obviously going to need to use so-called tricks in order to, you know, tease out some sense from this, and how, you know, you're always, you know, just really, you know, like sweeping away, you know, just working through this murk.
Well, did this make you more sympathetic toward the skeptic? You know, they're the denialists who say it's all a hoax, which is an absurd position.
Mostly are these people. It's like the equivalent of the Discovery Institute,
right?
You know, where you come up with two scientists who actually have any qualifications who may hold this position,
right?
And then you get signatures signed by you know, like you know, these, like an assistant professor of agricultural science at you know, West something.
Don't even say it, George. You'll hear from the people at that college, and they will slam.
Well, that's why I wanted to make up something completely fake.
Right.
Anyone with the job in academia has my great respect.
Sure.
But as opposed to individual exceptions. But
as opposed to
yeah. But yeah. So how do you be transparent about such a difficult science, and you know, the public, you know, wants things to be conceptualized, you know, in a way that they can, you know, they don't want to become experts in climatology or in statistical analysis, and
right.
They need these little summaries. But then by summarizing, you're always going to be probably framing or skewing or spinning one way or the other without necessarily intending to.
And
it's,
I guess,
difficult.
In defense of the people who are trying to spin as hard as they can and are maybe even resorting to some subterfuge, they see this as a crisis, and
yeah.
That there are potentially disastrous consequences in our near future,
yeah.
If we don't do something really significant right away. So that makes this different than, let's say, arguing about evolution or arguing about string theory. When, you know, who gives
a damn,
yeah. Really?
Because I was going to ask you, I mean, I imagine if somebody hacked into a computer at Oxford University and got Richard Dawkins' emails with, say, Daniel Dennett and other people, Christopher Hitchens, and, you know, talking about evolutionists.
Yeah.
And this came out, you know. I mean,
well, I don't think they would. I don't think they would be saying anything that would suggest that.
But they don't say anyway.
Right. I don't see those guys.
Well, that's true. They, yeah.
I don't see
yeah,
those guys
yeah.
biting their tongues very much.
Yeah, good point.
But you know, another reason I find this whole issue so daunting is, you know, first you've got the science. How much has the temperature actually risen historically and very recently? How tightly is that correlated with increases in CO2? Okay, that's one whole issue, a sort of straightforward empirical issue. Then you've got the whole question of what to do about it. And
then it becomes political.
Well, I actually spent some time. I realized that I didn't really understand cap and trade very well. And so I spent some time yesterday, you know, on Wikipedia and some other sites trying to understand it. And what was disconcerting is that I was more befuddled when I was done than when I started. And
it seems like a pretty basic idea to me.
Okay.
But maybe I'm missing
something.
Okay,
summarize it for me.
Well, let's see. So we have this big pool of, say, carbon pollution credits, we can call them.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that I have this factory, and I decide I'm going to invest in putting, scrubbing technology in my smokestacks and keep a certain amount of carbon out of the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And then I do this, and then if it's certified that I do this, I get a little certificate issued by the government
mm-hmm.
that represents how much carbon that I took out of the air. And then I can sell this
mm-hmm.
to someone who has one of these smokestacks, but thinks it might be a little cheaper for him to buy the credit than for him to doesn't have the resources to have put the scrubbers in himself just now, and then he can have a credit, and then you'll just have he'll still be polluting because he'll have the credit that'll allow him to do this, but the other guy will be polluting less, so you have a net loss.
Yeah.
You know, right, yeah, net negative in how much carbon is going into the atmosphere, and then you develop this whole economy where, you know, these things trade around, and then you let Goldman Sachs take it over so they can make huge amounts of money on it.
Yeah.
And then pump up the economy until we get another bubble. And this time, we'll all know what's going on. When the bubble's really near the peak, we'll know to sell all of our stocks.
Okay.
And then the bubble will collapse, and we can retire.
Okay, so I think you are suggesting that there is a little subterfuge in this as well. which was...
Well, any time they come up with a system that's going to really... I mean, it reminds me of, oh, yeah, we figured out now how, you know, we're going to eliminate risk from the financial markets with these great financial instruments that will distribute the risk, you know, over this huge pool, so that any kind of perturbations will be dampened very quickly and the economy will never collapse. So it's, well, so you know, so this is, we're doing this with carbon now.
Well, here's what
would be.
I'll just tell you that what sort of crystallized my confusion over this was a pair of op-ed pieces in the Times on December 7th. So one is by James Hansen, who of course is the NASA climatologist, who was one of the, I guess, the, really the first prominent scientist to warn about global warming, I think in the very early 90s, maybe even late 80s, and has become...
Yeah, during the modern era, yeah.
Right, has become more and more alarmed over time. His rhetoric really heated up.
Yeah.
And so in this piece, it's called Cap and Fade, and he's basically saying that cap and trade is a really bad idea. It's going to make things much worse. He says it's been widely praised, but does little to slow global warming or reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. It merely allows, and he's basically saying what you're saying, polluters and Wall Street traders to fleece the public out of billions of dollars. And
well, that's certainly the negative side.
Okay, right next to it is Paul Krugman. All right?
Yeah, Krugman thinks it's great.
Nobel
right?
Prize winning economist. And, you know, he's as green as they come. He's a lefty.
Yeah.
You know, politically, he's, I'm sure, very aligned with James Hansen. And what's bizarre is that he is saying that the truth is conservative. He's basically complaining about the conservative critics of cap and trade. You've got on the far end of the green spectrum, you've got people like Hansen saying cap and trade is a bad idea. On the far right, you also have people who are saying that cap and trade is a bad idea, and Krugman is basically criticizing the conservatives who have a problem with it and saying that it's capitalism at its best. Let the marketplace solve this problem.
Right.
And he's saying how wrong the Republicans are for opposing it. So what the hell are you supposed to believe if you've got these two?
Well, again, it's a political question rather than a scientific one. But I mean, just because someone ends up benefiting from this economically doesn't mean per se that it's bad. But on the other hand, you know, there's the whole question of how you make sure these people are really doing what they say they're doing to earn the credits. This was something, you know, there's someone who's kind of associated with the whole kind of Amy Goodman part of culture who did this cartoon about cap and trade.
Uh-huh.
Have you seen that?
No.
It's on the web somewhere. It's an animation, and it, basically, takes the, it's just another way for Goldman Sachs to make lots of money. Kind of conspiracy theory look at it, but also brings up some very valid points, like how do you verify this stuff?
Right.
You know, as Ronald Reagan said, the great communicator, trust but verify.
Well, this is the big issue in Copenhagen right now is how you verify the claims of various countries, and I guess China is the one that a lot of the attention is being focused on now, that they have indeed reduced their emissions as much as they say, and the United States is demanding more transparency on the part of
China. It's going to be worse than monitoring nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
You know, nuclear weapon buildup, except it's going to involve many more countries. And
I think...
One thing is cartoon. You know, I had this example, and I don't know how valid this is, but, one of the industrialists, and, they're like these guys with top hats carrying the big bags of money with dollar signs, like from the old, Depression era comics. One of them has this factory, and it says, "Well, I was going to expand this factory, to twice its current size, but now I'm not going to do that. So, I get carbon credits, and then I can sell them." So how do you? I mean, I can't believe that the system would be so sloppy that would count as a carbon credit. I mean, surely they would just take things that were already in the ground and producing and saying that, you know, if we're going to reduce our carbon output by 25%, and then we get this credit. And I do agree. It sounds like a very slow, gradual, excruciating kind of process that's not going to have any kind of payoff. Maybe, who knows, decades, century.
Well, apparently it worked really well with sulfur dioxide with the emissions that were causing acid rain. So I think a cap and trade was instituted in the early 80s and very rapidly reduced. I mean, it basically, I don't know if it eliminated the acid rain problem, but it certainly ameliorated it a lot. I remember when I was...
Well, you certainly don't hear about it anymore. No, that was the global warming of the 80s, right?
That's right. And it was really bad. It was bad here in the Northeast. You had a lot of forests that were dying, that were basically being burned, by acid rain, and ponds that were becoming so acidic that all the fish in them were dying.
So why then? Yeah, if it worked for sulfur dioxide, why wouldn't it work for?
Yeah, I don't know.
For carbon.
I don't know, but it's. Yeah. I must say that the whole climate change thing is daunting. I like to come to a hard position that I can defend past all reason on different issues, and it's been difficult on climate change.
Well, yeah, then with this whole layer of global politics on top of it, it just makes it so, you know, I mean, so many people latching onto this, and they're just using it as a way to, you know, express their resentment against the industrialized world.
Hey,
sometimes rightfully so, and sometimes not.
I see we're already at 40 minutes. I want to mention something now. I forget if it was the last time we spoke or a couple of times ago about the Green Book Award, and I was looking for nominations. And I have now picked the winner of the Center for Science, the Stevens Institute Center for Science Writing's Green Book Award, which we give out every year to a book that we think makes a really compelling case for environmental awareness. The winner last year was Jeffrey Sachs, the Columbia economist, and another winner was Edward Wilson, the Harvard biologist, and we're giving it this year to somebody who's of that stature, Sylvia Earle, the great oceanographer, and I'm holding up the book that she wrote that just came out this year called The World is Blue, which is, it's alarming, actually. It's basically talking about how we are destroying the oceans, which just a few decades ago were thought to be so vast that they could withstand anything that humans did to them. And now I guess it's common knowledge that that human activities are having a tremendous impact on the oceans. So, for example, Earl says that we've lost about 90% of the big fish, like tuna, sharks have been really overfished. Some of these fish are really endangered now. She also talks about how the corals are dying around the world. I guess we've lost about 50% of the coral. But then she's hopeful too. She talks about some of the things that we can do to try to slow down the destruction. She does think that we have to do something about global warming because she thinks that the gradual rise in sea temperature and the oceans are actually becoming more acidic because of more carbon in the atmosphere. That has something to do with the coral. Anyway, it's a great book, filled with fun facts and really informative, very eloquent, very passionate. She'll be coming to Stevens in April to receive the award, so I'm really thrilled. She already accepted it.
Hey, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, I've already put in for a copy.
Okay, good. Thank you. And you know, so one of the most disconcerting things about the book was that she's talking about some creatures of the oceans that I never really thought I needed to have much empathy for, like like shrimp and squid.
Yeah.
I mean, I love calamari. She's got these descriptions of what it's like to be deep sea diving and run into squid, and they can be really curious, and they come up and are checking her out the same way that she's checking them out, and she talks about how
squids are pretty smart.
And octopus.
As well. Yeah, you sent me a link to this video of.
Yeah, did you see
an octopus built? Yeah, so I get this link from John Horgan saying, look at this amazing video of an octopus building a house with coconuts. And it is an amazing video, but I have to admit that I was a little disappointed.
How? In what way?
I mean, the idea was that octopuses are so intelligent, so I thought I was going to see this octopus and was going to go get one coconut and then like maybe break it in two and put it down and then, you know, underwater, of course, and then, you know, like set the foundation and then put in walls and things and then put a roof over its head. But, you know, basically it like takes the coconut shell like a big hat and like puts it on and, you know, and then kind of, and then uses it to sleep under.
Well, so the one, so we saw the same video, but actually I've seen a few videos now, and it actually, I think what's amazing is it finds one half of a coconut, but then it goes and finds another half of a coconut, and then it puts itself inside it. It sort of snuggles down into one half, and then it pulls the other half over its header, I don't know what you call it, and then his eyeballs are kind of peeking out of this. So it's basically snuggled there inside the coconut shell.
Well, yeah, that's pretty cool.
Which is
pretty
remarkable.
Yeah.
And then I saw another video that shows that these things then this particular octopus. I think this is off the coast of Bali or somewhere in that general area, and it's a little octopus, and it's in an area where there isn't a lot of natural cover, so they're very vulnerable to predators, and they take advantage of coconuts. And they had another picture of one that again took two halves of a coconut shell, got inside, and then to transport itself, it rolls around in the coconut.
Okay, now that's invented the wheel on those.
That's
pretty cool.
That was pretty impressive.
No, octopuses are pretty amazing.
Well, there's another. So apparently, the guys who took the video of this thing collecting the two shells, and it also walks around with the shells. It's transporting them in a really weird way.
Yeah.
And they said that this is the first tool use ever observed by invertebrates. And and immediately people said that's completely wrong. It's not only not the first tool use observed in invertebrates, it's not even the first time an octopus has been observed using tools. And I found a little story on the web by another group of scientists about it actually dates back to the 1960s. And this guy said that he had collected some small octopus, and it was in his hand, and it stung him really sharply. And so he couldn't figure out what it was, because he could tell it wasn't biting him with its beak. It seemed to be coming from its tentacles. And so then he got a bunch of other these little octopi, whatever.
Octopi.
And,
well, I guess it's like there's octopi and different types of octopi or octopuses.
I just like to say octopus.
You know, it's like fish and fishes. Yeah.
So he got all these other ones, and they were stinging him too. And so he examined their tentacles really closely, and he found that what they had done is ripped shreds off the tentacles of man-o-war jellyfish and attached them to their own tentacles and used them as weapons to ward off predators.
Wow. Just shows you that warfare is endemic.
I'm going to take that as a segue. And
just as President Obama said.
Yeah. Okay, so...
I've given you a segue.
Thanks for bringing that up. I was really bothered. I am Barack Obama's biggest fan. I think I'm more excited still by him than any other president we've had in my lifetime. I felt sort of the same way about Bill Clinton, but I see even more potential upside of Obama. I was really, really disappointed when he announced that he was sending 30,000 extra troops to Afghanistan. He's got, you know, a quick timetable for getting them out after that, but it still really bothered me. And then I was really bothered by his Nobel speech, acceptance speech as well, which I think was, you know, the guy is so eloquent, but there were some parts of it that, as you probably know, would just really set me off. So one is that he says war in one form, you know, he's basically trying to justify, to his credit, he realizes how awkward it is for him to be accepting this peace prize right after he has escalated the war in Afghanistan. So he's basically saying, trying to explain his reasoning for the surge and his somewhat hawkish policy in general. And he says, war, in one form or another, appeared with the first man.
Right.
That's an empirical statement, actually, and it happens to be completely unsubstantiated by science. It really bugs
me. Yeah.
He's basically reiterating the claim that the anthropologist Richard Wrangham at Harvard and others have been making, that that group violence, lethal group violence, goes all the way back to the common ancestor that we share with chimpanzees, and that there is no evidence for that. And it really bugs me that it's seeped all this attitude has gone all the way up to our commander-in-chief, who is using it to justify his hawkish foreign policy.
I don't think it's something that most people assume is true. Like, I was very surprised to hear all the evidence against that you've marshaled in some of our past conversations.
It's just I don't know what can be done to change that. I've talked to a bunch of paleoanthropologists now about this, and all of them say that there's absolutely no evidence of lethal violence among Australopithecines, Homo habilis, or even early humans before like 12,000 years ago. And, you know, it may have happened. There certainly was some one-on-one violence, I'm sure, but it's just wrong for somebody in such a position of power to be making what's essentially a scientific claim that has no factual basis. And, and then, the money shot. We must begin by acknowledging the hard truth that we will not eradicate violent conflict in our lifetimes. There will be times when nations acting individually or in concert will find the use of force not only necessary but morally justified. I hate that fatalism. And, you know, Obama actually cites, he refers several times to a famous speech by JFK given in June 1963. It's sometimes called his peace speech. And it's not a good comparison because JFK was rejecting fatalism toward war in that speech. He says, "Too many of us think it is impossible to achieve peace. Too many think it's unreal. But that is a dangerous, defeatist belief. It leads to the conclusion that war is inevitable, that mankind is doomed, that we are gripped by forces we cannot control. We need not accept that view." That's the kind of rhetoric I want from a commander-in-chief.
No, I agree. And I mean, even if you... I mean, deciding whether warfare or aggression is endemic is something that's going to be argued probably forever. But whether it is or not, just the... You know, taking that as this fatalistic, well, we can't do anything about it, so we need to prepare for it, instead of, you know, we can rise above this. You know, we're intelligent human beings, and we don't have to be trapped entirely by our biological urges.
Right.
You know, the old Robert Wright kind of sermon.
Yeah, you know, JFK, this wasn't just empty rhetoric. In this speech, this is when he declared a unilateral cessation on atmospheric nuclear testing by the United States that led directly to the test ban treaty with the Soviet Union. That was inspirational. It was creative, and it actually was a really important step toward peace. And in terms of this, you know, Obama saying we can't have peace in our lifetime, I mean, humanity can, we can actually do so much more than pessimists give us credit for. I mean, nobody in the mid-80s thought that the Cold War had any chance of ending peacefully, and yet it did. It's one of the great progressive events in human history. And, you know, I just wish Obama would get out of this this pessimistic funk that he seems to be in right now.
Yeah, well, something I've said before, it still continually strikes me, and not just this, but so many issues, is we really need another Franklin D. Roosevelt. And
in terms of...
You know, someone that's, I mean, mostly this comes to mind with, you know, dealing with the economy and Wall Street and the banking crisis, and you know, just not being so willing to accept business as usual. Oh, and then with healthcare, or being or just this bipartisan. Oh, excuse me, I'm about to sneeze. bipartisanship on healthcare, and you know, just basically say we won the election. You know, this is the agenda, and then just really push that. You know, of course you're going to have to make compromises to get it through, but I think there's just a lot more compromises than I had hoped on so many fronts.
Yeah, I, you know, I actually felt a little bit, I've gotten depressed about the healthcare situation. I was, we actually were going to talk about it last time, but didn't get around to it. I was really...
Oh, yeah, there was a really good article by Atul Gawande, another one in the New Yorker.
Right. I was going to mention even before that the reaction to this big new study on the value of mammograms that recommended that women, at least women who are not at high risk, who don't have a family history of very early onset of breast cancer, that they not get tested until they're 50. You know, used to start when you're 40, and then I think you're supposed to get a mammogram every single year. Now it's every 2 years after you turn 50. And there was this outcry from...
That really bothered you, didn't it?
It really did
bother me. That's
right.
We talked about... We talked about this on... and then the recording got sabotaged.
That's right.
By my computer. Yeah, so it never actually aired.
Well, it's you know my attitude on testing. It's just I feel that it's, you know, the only way you can look at healthcare is in its totality and try to get the most health value for your investment. And there are some people who were arguing when it came to mammograms and testing in general. This has also been true of tests for prostate cancer, that it doesn't matter if we can just save, it doesn't matter how much we spend and how much time it takes, if there's just a 1 in 10,000 chance that you might get cancer over the next 5 years, you've got to be tested for that. And it's just ridiculous, because it's that kind of thinking that led to the enormous increases in healthcare spending in this country. We spent 50% more than the next closest country per capita on health care. The United States spends 50% more than, I think it's Norway, which is number two, and we're twice as much as a lot of countries that, like England, that have much better health care outcomes, higher or longer lifespan than the United States.
Yeah.
So it's just people are so irrational.
I don't know. I mean, I really disagree with you on the breast testing issue, but I don't think we have time to really get into that today.
Well, so, okay, quickly the...
we're getting up on an hour here.
Well, quickly, I'll just mention the Gawande. I'll just tell people to read it, because it's a fascinating article. He had that amazing article several months ago on finding that there's an inverse correlation between... the amount that we spend on healthcare in given counties, for example, and the healthcare that's actually delivered to people in those counties. And in this piece, he's making this really interesting comparison between the way that we're going to try to improve healthcare outcomes and reduce costs with this new big healthcare bill. An analogy between that and what was done to decrease the costs of producing food in this country at the beginning of the last century.
Oh, that's a fascinating parallel that, you know, I've never seen anyone make that.
Yeah. This guy is brilliant. How he has...
Yeah, so basically around, you know, like farming was so inefficient around the turn of the 20th century. You know, and farmers would basically, you know, they'd get a piece of land and then do some shallow plowing, plant some seeds, and then they would grow crops until they'd exhausted it and then move on to another piece of land because there was plenty of land in the Midwest and the West. And so that was very inefficient. And then there's all the problems of getting food to market and then predicting the weather so that, you could have a bad year and your crop would be ruined and then the prices would go up. And, of course, there were people, you know, speculating on this and making lots of money on grain futures and things. But I guess the net effect was that food was much more expensive, or much more bigger chunk of our spending per capita than it is now because of these inefficiencies.
40 in 1900, more than 40% of a family's income went toward
40%
food.
And then the government came and decided to do something about
it.
And he really kind of embodies this in the county extension agents that are, you know, just everywhere now, and then just going to the farmers and saying, look, you know, we've done these scientific studies, and if you rotate your crops or if you use this kind of fertilizer, or you use deeper plowing, and the farmers would say, well, you know, this is this bullshit science stuff. You know, this is how we've always done it. And they'd say, well, you know, just why don't you do that plot over there like this, and let's see what happens. And so they basically just seeded all these little experiments, and the government agents weren't sure what was going to work either, but they just kind of took this attitude as, you know, let's try all these little experiments with increasing the efficiency of farming and then see if we can slowly make it better.
Yeah.
And we weren't going to solve this overnight or over a decade, but
it was a very,
you know, eventually.
Sort of modest approach. It wasn't, you know, so Gawande brings up the... you know, the Soviet Union's collectivization program, which resulted in huge, wide-scale famine and deaths of millions of people.
Yeah, the top-down kind of thing.
Right.
Well, this is more bottom-up.
So
I guess the implication is you send the equivalent of county extension agents to doctor's offices.
Right.
And, well, you know, why don't you try doing it this way instead of that?
Right. Or, it's empirical.
Yeah.
And he was saying that the way he set it up in the article was he talks about this huge piece of legislation that's got all these pilot programs, and a cynic could think, pilot programs? How are we going to, you know, all these little tiny pilot programs, how can that possibly make a dent in this huge problem?
And that's where I thought he was going with the article.
Right. And then he says, he says that's exactly what succeeded with this other tremendous problem. So now, today, he says food accounts for... it went down from above 40% to less than 8% of the average household income. It's produced with 2% of the labor force. It used to be much, much higher than that. And it's produced on no more land than was devoted to it a century ago, even though our population, obviously, is so much greater. And food of greater variety and abundance than ever before. You know, so...
it's really interesting parallel.
Yeah, and it made... and I loved the fact that it was so... optimistic
and again not utopian, just saying like, look, it's going to be hard, this is a messy problem, you don't really understand all the interlacing factors, and let's just go out and try lots of different things over a long period of time and see if we can get it to work, which I guess, you know, you could make that argument for global warming as well, for climate change.
I think that's what it's going to take. I mean,
you
know, with all these massive problems, hey, it's going to take that with war, too. Approach it on all different fronts. There's no magic
solution. Let a thousand flowers bloom.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
But we've got optimism is a prerequisite, and it's a political... it's a political act. Just saying that we can
just
turn
to be optimistic.
Things. Yeah.
Wow. Learned optimism. There's a really good book called that.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you can learn to be optimistic instead of pessimistic.
I've become almost ridiculously optimistic in my old age.
That's good. I need to work on that.
Yeah. I think it helps having kids. I think that kind of triggers the optimism program.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah.
So, well,
anything else for? I guess we
got to the octopus. The octopuses. That was the only thing that I wanted to make
sure.
Yeah,
that's what everything was kind of, you know, converging on that.
Yeah. So I'll post a link to that because that'll put people in a good mood for the holidays.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah. Coconut houses built by octopi.
Yeah.
Okay, John.
All right.
So I'll see you after Christmas sometime.
Yeah, sounds good. I'll have more hockey games under my belt by then.
All right. Be careful out there.
All right. Merry Christmas, George.
Okay, Merry Christmas.